So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here with The Modern Man. Hope you're very well. I've had an interesting day. The sun was out today, and I thought I should take advantage. Even though I had to do the final edit polish on this show, I thought, you know, sod it. How often do you get to take advantage of being a freelancer and enjoying the sunshine? So off we went. I packed the wife and kid into the car, and we drove half an hour to Wimpole Hall, which is this absolutely picture-perfect National Trust property with like a walled garden and an overpriced coffee shop, the whole thing. And it just seemed absolutely like a beautiful, perfect English day. And it's spring, so the lambs were being born. And we wheeled my son Harvey in his buggy to the farm that they have there. And that was like a 20-minute walk from the car park. But when we finally got there, oh, the lambs were so cute. And I said to Harvey, do you want to see the little lambs? And I picked him out of his buggy. And at that exact moment, and I'm not exaggerating this for comic effect, he spewed all over himself, all over the floor, all down my arm. And he's 2 years old, so this isn't like baby vomit. This is like proper adult, chunky, sick vomit. So we had to turn straight back home again. 20-minute walk to the car park, half an hour drive back home. And now here I am, talking to you, still smelling ever so faintly of sick. So that has been my day. And our middle feature this week is about the lengths that a dad will go to look after his son. It is an astonishing story, actually, and beautifully told. It came thanks to man fan Chris, who emailed me to say, Ollie, I love the show. I'd like to suggest you interview Ben Ryan. His son needed to have an arm amputated after birth, but Ben wasn't happy with the state of infant prosthetics, so without any engineering background, he invented a new type of hydraulic prosthetic, which can be 3D printed to the exact necessary size. That is a pretty good summary of the story that Chris gives, but Ben obviously has more to say than just that. He is exactly as impressive a figure as that summary suggests. I think you'll really enjoy the interview with him. Also, the foxhole this week is a lot of fun. It's a little reminiscent of My Dad Wrote a Porno, because it is the sound of two blokes and a lady giggling about erotica. But as always with Alex, it is an education. I would just say, though, if you have a job and you want to keep it, wear headphones. Wear headphones for today's foxhole. It is even more NSFW than normal. You are perfectly safe to Bluetooth away for the rest of the show, though. Now, a reminder before we get going that this is the last episode of our current series. I know, I'm sad as well. The date for your diaries, by the way, is June the 26th. We're going to be back with Season 8 on June the 26th. But we are only able to bring you these 30 episodes a year thanks to contributions from listeners like you. So firstly, sponsorship. If you enjoy the show and you have access to a marketing budget and you think that it would benefit your company to have me talking about your product in this bit, reaching other clever, curious, culturally aware man fans like yourself, consider taking out a sponsorship slot on the show. All you need to do is fill out the feedback form on our website, modernmanwith2ns.co.uk, and I'll get back to you about that. And if you're just a normal listener who scabs this podcast for free, that is fine. You're my people. I love the fact that we are free to download. But do remember, this show is not free to produce. You know, think back across the amazing stories that we have brought you this series alone. Kwaku Adeboli on being Britain's biggest rogue trader, Manny Wax and his extraordinary story of surviving abuse, Raquel Messager challenging our perception of public space. Those are the kinds of stories that don't just land in my lap. They take time and travel and effort. I always record face to face. We're not part of a broadcasting organisation. We're completely independent. We can only bring you more stories like that with your support. So do say thanks by buying us a beer. If you can afford to do it monthly as a one-off payment or via PayPal, all the links are on our website. Just click Beer money. Thank you very much. Right, on this week's season finale, you will learn how to get the best meal when eating out, you will learn what myelination is, and you'll learn why you need to ditch your red satin sheets, Casanova. Let's go. On this week's Modern Man.
NHS have been trying to make him an arm since October. I've tried four times and they can't get it right. I did it in 5 days.
Technology, passion, and a trip to B&Q. The man who built his son an arm.
It did make me laugh a little bit that she stared at it so long and then asked him if he was going to wash it.
And Alex Fox picks her top audio treats to amuse and arouse. But first, it's the zeitgeist, all the trends you need to know about for the week ahead with a man who has spent this week filming a man cooking a hedgehog. It's Ollie Pitt.
What a horrendous smell.
What are your trends for the week?
Crush. Shh.
Is this the juice bar?
No.
Oh.
It's an app, but I said it like that because it's got two H's on the end. Sometimes, when you're texting somebody, it's really difficult to know whether or not they like you or not.
My grandma sent me a unicorn emoji this week.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. She's 91 years old. It's fucking brilliant.
Congratulations to her. But what did that mean? What context is that in? Your gran might hate you, but you wouldn't know. But with Crush, it uses...
I can't believe you just said my grandma might hate me.
Well, she might do. You don't know. It's not like you have any kind of... But this app would use artificial intelligence to tell you whether or not by reading your text messages.
But how would it understand intonation and all the things that computers historically have problems with?
Well, I spoke to the chap that set it up, a guy called S. He's a computer scientist chap, and he wanted to find a way to determine what people mean within text messages, like the real meaning behind it. So their mood, whether they like you or not, whether they're in love with you or not. So he decided to write an algorithm that sifts through your SMS messages, the frequency of your SMS messages, and also your phone calls, and provide you with a score that tells you whether you like someone or they like you.
How accurate is it then?
Initially, not very. It's been going since the middle of last year, and he told me that they'd basically collated loads of data and feedback from their users. They got over 100,000 users, and people basically feeding back saying, no, you're wrong, I like this person way more than you said that I have.
But this could just be a relationship ruiner, couldn't it?
Interesting you say that, Ollie, because I've done it with you.
Have you?
Yes.
You've uploaded our text conversations without my permission
in the cloud.
Or consent.
Yeah, it's all there.
Christ.
So
I know this already. You'll often send me quite a polite and friendly sort of four-sentence text, and I reply with one word.
Yeah. And here it is. You like them way more. Look at that. Look at that deterioration in that graph that goes up. You liked me loads.
Yeah.
And then after...
Well, that's when I was like, oh, yeah, let's get this guy to be part of the
cool,
podcast.
Outgoing cool, incoming cool, outgoing cool.
Then when you were part
cool,
of the podcast
cool.
And just harassing me about bullshit, I was like, yeah, fine, whatever, see you at 3 o'clock.
I was also... sending you links to where I was on Google Maps, which is quite needy, isn't it?
Because I did find that weird. Now we have an opportunity to discuss it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, you didn't want to know where I was.
No, I don't want to track your journey to meet me. It's just weird.
Why not?
Like, because it's one thing if we're like meeting at a festival or something, and I want to know when you're going to get to the ice cream truck. You'd already said you were leaving the house. I don't need to know exactly when you're going to come and arrive.
What if you were masturbating?
What else have you got for us this week?
Could this be the summer of cold brew coffee?
Wasn't last year the summer of cold brew coffee?
Kind of, but this year it's growing even more because this year we've got fizzy cold brew coffee.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I've never even had cold brew coffee.
What?
I've seen it.
Get out.
Well, I've had a frappuccino. I presume that doesn't count. That's basically a milkshake, isn't
doesn't
it?
Doesn't count at all. You've had iced tea.
Yes.
Yeah, cold brew coffee is the same principle, but you get a really decent caffeine hit. It's lovely in the summer. And there's a company called Sandow's. The two owners there, Hugh Duffy and Luke Sudard, set it up in London. Mm-hmm. So the way that this works is that the coffee grounds are just brewed cold. So they're covered in water, brewed cold for up to 24 hours. And then you get like this concentrated coffee essence. And then they kind of dilute it to taste it. So it's not brewed hot like normal coffee. But they've decided now to do cold brew coffee fizzy.
Right.
And I've got some here for you to try. I've got the normal one first if you want to sample that, because then it's like
I've never had it before,
A-B testing, isn't it?
Okay, so. It's mild, actually. I was expecting, when you said strong, like, caffeine thing, mm-hmm. The only time I've ever had cold coffee is when you go to, like, a Japanese or a Chinese supermarket and you get one of those really intense sugary milky ones.
I know the ones you mean, yeah.
That is just like Red Bull, but, you know, worse. Whereas this is actually quite a soft, gentle hint of caffeine.
This is why I want to see if the fizzy stuff add something.
Okay, this is flavoured sparkling spice cold brew coffee.
Yeah, don't sound so surprised. I mean, at Christmas you get spiced coffee, like gingerbread lattes, all that kind of stuff.
I quite like that, but I wouldn't describe it as sparkling coffee. I'd describe it as more like a soda. It tastes like Dr. Pepper, basically. It tastes like a weird brew of sort of dark, fizzy stuff. It's actually not... When you say sparkling coffee, I actually thought I was going to retch.
Yeah, no, that's
not... And we've
not...
tried a lot of weird fucking coffee on this show. We've put salt in it, we put butter in it.
We have, yeah.
You made... What was your thing called? Carrot tea.
Carrot tea. Yes. I can't believe that was me picking
I can't believe that isn't the drink of the summer.
It's like... It's fruity, isn't it? That's nice. I like that.
I actually genuinely don't mind that.
Should we try the other
and
one?
I was ready to say it was horrible. Yeah, so the other one is citrus.
Now, I'd imagine this is just going to taste like... Well, fizzy lemon.
I wouldn't know that was coffee unless you... Yeah, that tastes like lemonade.
Does it?
So it tastes nice, but it tastes like Arbites. That's what it tastes like.
Yeah, but...
See what I mean?
Just,
I think basically what they've done is they're obviously a manufacturer of cold brew coffee. That's gone really well over the last few years. And they've obviously tried to expand their brand.
Mm-hmm.
And they've thought, what can we do that is still true to our nature? So it's coffee-based, but it isn't coffee. I mean, that isn't coffee. That is a soft drink. One tastes like Sprite, one tastes like Dr. Pepper. It just happens to be based on coffee rather than carbonated caffeine of another kind.
It looks like it belongs on the shelf at a Pret-a-Manger.
Or any place that's trying to get you to pay too much for a Coke.
Yeah.
I mean, I bet that'll cost about £2, even though it's half the size of a Coke.
Yeah.
Because it's a refined Coke.
Because it's in a smaller can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that wasn't horrible. I was actually pleasantly surprised. When you said, normally you get me to taste any coffee, it is revolting. I'm pleasantly surprised. All right. Time to catch up on how you fared on last week's challenge. It was from Man Fan Haley, who tasked you with exploring the world of fashion resale. Last week you didn't know what a fashion drop was. Do you now know what a fashion drop is?
So a fashion drop is basically when a brand like Supreme, they're a skateboard brand, will announce that they're going to release some new stock.
Yeah.
And it will arrive in their stores on a certain day, which is actually usually a Thursday in their Soho store in London.
Is that what I've seen then? When I said that there was a queue going around Carnaby Street, that's the Soho store of Supreme, is
that's
it?
That's it.
It's just a shop.
Yep.
Like, it's an event, so you sort of think it must be like a pop-up or something, but it isn't. It's just a shop.
It's just a shop, and it happens every week, and you get a list of the products that are going to arrive in that store.
That's mental, because they're still queuing on Saturdays.
Yeah. It's not just the stores. It gets way more complicated. There's a lot more behind it. There's a big community behind it. There's a website, actually a Facebook group, called The Basement. It started as a reselling group. Remember we talked about Wavy Garms?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a little
teenagers
bit like that.
Swapping 90s clothes with each other.
But it's turned into like a massive fashion community.
I love it when you do these millennial explainers for me.
But on this Facebook group, they share pictures of the clothes that they've bought, and they also talk about when the next drops are going to be. And Supreme don't just drop in their stores. They will do secret drops. So they'll say, if you follow the right groups, they'll say, we're going to do a drop in this warehouse at this time on this day. And then the super fans will turn up and then get the swag or cop.
Is
goes.
That the word?
Yeah, cop. They get their cops. Yeah, wow. They cop it. That sounds cool, doesn't it?
And how much do they have to pay in cash?
For
the cop?
Well, it varies. So you can get anything from a key ring, which might cost you £40 or something, £30. And then you can go right up to buying a massive jacket, which is a North Face collaboration with Supreme that will cost you hundreds of pounds.
When I was 16, I didn't have hundreds of pounds to spend on a jacket.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing 16-year-olds don't now either. But I'm also guessing what happens is they end up reselling the stuff and then they make profit and then they use that money to buy more clothes. Is that it?
A lot of them do that, yeah. And one of the biggest resellers is a chap called Leo Mandela, and he's a 15-year-old, and his Instagram handle is Gully Guy Leo, and he has over 640,000 followers on Instagram. And he is...
And he's a bloke who goes and buys tracky bottoms and sells them on.
Yeah, well, that's how he started. That's how he started. And now he is, like, the poster boy for this streetwear scene. But it's an entire community. It's not just, like, kids just queuing up. They actually feel like they belong to this bigger thing. And that's why it's like, well, why are you buying so much Supreme stuff, which is basically just a logo? Like, one of the items was a logo on a hockey mask.
Yeah.
Why are you going there just to buy a hockey mask? It's just
and the answer is because it's a limited edition. And
yeah, they just want to feel part of the community.
So, okay, you're talking about all this in the abstract, which makes me fearful that, in fact, you haven't been and made a load of money.
Well, because it... I know it sounds like an excuse, but it is. The time. So I'd have to have...
You had 10 days!
I would have had to queue up on a Wednesday evening to get in on the Thursday morning, it opens at 11. But what I tried...
Unbelievable. Just a little bit of overnight dedication queuing in the street with some 16-year-olds.
This is a hard-to-break community. I can't just turn up in my Salt Rock t-shirt. They'd be like, who's this old bastard? But I found a website called TaskRabbit, is also an app.
Yes, no, I've heard of them. So they're the people that you farm off to do tasks on your behalf.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're going to pay someone to do your challenge for you.
I'm going to pay someone to queue for me. But the problem I had is I couldn't get them the money in time because I couldn't get down to London. So what I'm going to do...
What do you mean, get them the money? Can't you transfer the person the money?
Yeah, but you have to pay them first, and then I didn't want to pay them, and then it's like... Well, you didn't...
You didn't want it to come out of our show budget. You didn't want to effectively ask me to pay you some money so that you could pay someone else some money because you couldn't be asked to queue in the street because of the challenge that we're paying you to do.
It's not that I couldn't be asked.
No, that's basically it.
No, it's not. I just had to find someone that looked more suitable.
Right.
So yeah, I wouldn't fit in.
Okay, so are you going to get a 16-year-old to invoice me to go and get you some caps? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm going to hire someone to queue overnight.
So how much is it for someone to stand in the queue for you?
Varies between £12 an hour, right up to £30 an hour.
£12 an hour overnight?
Yeah, come on. I mean,
that's more than it costs to put you on a massive billboard in Slough.
Listen, I can make some serious wedge reselling a hockey mask with Supreme on it, Ollie.
I think a punishment should be administered.
What?
And I actually have a good idea of what that might be. Later on in the show, in the foxhole.
Don't look at me like that.
No, this is good. Alex has been preparing some sexy clips for us to listen to, and I know how much you enjoy at the end of the series, gatecrashing the foxhole section.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're going to do that to you, Ollie.
Okay, great.
See you then.
Bye.
Hello, Man fans. I'm Joanna, and I'm a freelance food and drinks journalist. Here are my life hacks on how to get the best meal when you're eating out. Tip number one, what is your meal made of? As my mother would say, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. If the raw ingredients they're working with aren't good quality, then the meal they make from it won't be. So try and find out if they use organic veg, work with the seasons, get their fish from a Marine Stewardship Council supplier. A chef who takes pride in his work will take care over the food he's working with. Tip number two, remember, it's hospitality. In food, it's really easy to get elitist. It's impossible to get a table at X, or have you heard Y won't let you in trainers? While it matters to create a nice environment, that environment is being created for you, the guest. As Chef Tom Kerridge would say, it's an honour for restaurants to have you in their place, when there's so much choice elsewhere rather than the other way round. Somewhere that's snooty or with poor customer service just isn't worth it, no matter how special or on trend it might seem. We've all had meals in places that have been made great because the staff were so lovely. Eating out is more than just the food. Tip number three, ignore the hype. Sometimes a queue is a good sign, and sometimes it's a sign of just how sheep-like and idiotic we all are. Is it worth queuing for a place like Bao, where you can't get it anywhere else? Yes. Is it worth queuing for brunch at Breakfast Club? Absolutely not. Some of the best places to eat are in odd locations and have no PR machine behind them to generate publicity. Simpsons on the Strand, Quo Vadis, even Mabel's, the original vegan restaurant, all have stood the test of time. So don't follow the hype. Go where you feel is good. Remember, a good meal is a sum of its parts. Your anticipation, the welcome you receive, the atmosphere in the place, who you're with, and then last of all, the food itself. Really good fish and chips on the promenade at Margate is just as good as fine dining in central London. I'm Joanna, and you can follow me on Twitter at @Joanna_Derry, @JoannaDerry for more tips and thoughts from my head.
Now, if you've ever conceived a child, I am prepared to bet that you'll remember where you were when you found out. Because even if it's your second pregnancy, or your third, or your fourth, or even if it's unwanted and you intend not to have the baby, it is a moment where you feel the path of your life is about to change. Former psychology teacher Ben Ryan was working as a kitchen designer when he got the call, and his life soon changed even more than is the case for most of us.
I remember getting the call from Kate. We'd been trying for a child. We kept getting the timings wrong. And I remember getting a phone call to tell me that we were expecting. And I was just over the moon, really, really thrilled.
How long had you been trying for?
3 years. I thought there might be something wrong with either of us. So turns out we were just trying a week too late each time. So she bought a £20 tester thing. And once we got the timings right, we knew she was expecting within 2 weeks of trying. So and there'd been a long run up to the pregnancy as well. We both quit smoking, drinking plenty of juice, going running, exercising. We wanted to be as physically fit and as healthy to give our child the best possible start they could have.
And you'd been together for...
Since we met in university, so 1999, I think we met. But I was petrified that something would go wrong, that, you know, when we had the 20-week scan, I was worried that there would detect Downs. I just always thought there was going to be something wrong with my child, and I don't know why it put the fear of God into me.
Which is actually what everyone thinks, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. And I knew I wanted children, but I was really, really scared of the process. And my background's in developmental psychology. I understand the development of the nervous system inside the womb. And when you think about how actually freakish it is that any children are born safely, considering all the things that can go wrong.
And but nothing showed up on any of the scans that anything was wrong?
No, it was a normal, healthy pregnancy all the way through until Kate went into labour. Kate had a sweep, which was to try and speed things along.
Horrible euphemism, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a horrible euphemism.
Basically someone sticking their finger up.
Yeah, it was a long and very, very painful labour for Kate. There were unusual signs on the trace as well, which... in hindsight now, were a reason to do a cesarean, and Kate had opted to do a cesarean if there was any damage to the baby. Sadly, because of a political fallout between two local hospitals, so there was a blanket ban then across Wales, only do a cesarean if it's life or death. So sadly, if Sol had a cesarean, the chances are now we wouldn't be talking. There's lots of different reasons why you shouldn't use forceps, mainly to protect the limbs. You can break the neck of the baby if they're facing up instead of down. So the mother's laid on her back in the traditional birthing position and the baby is coming out the wrong way. Because of the shape of the canal that they're travelling through, if you try to put pressure on the head, it can literally decapitate the child or break the neck.
But forceps were used?
Forceps were used. First thing I remember burned into my memory is him being born, passed on to Kate, and Sol squeezing both my fingers on both my hands with his hands. He was very grey. He was very grey, I remember that, but he started to pink up very, very quickly. Within about half an hour, it was apparent that there was a kind of a line on his left arm where beneath that line it remained grey. And only many, many months afterwards did we find out, when we'd requested the documents, that there was no oxygen in his left hand and there was no blood pressure. So that is a medical emergency, and he should have been airlifted to Alderhay. But instead we were told that he'd be fine and that his arm would pink up and there was no need for any special measures. I thought that was wrong and tried to massage his arm, basically ignoring the doctors. It got to the point where I was shouting at them,
and
saying that there's something wrong, wrong.
You've been... I mean, obviously, your partner's been through a worse experience.
She was out of it completely at this stage. Yeah.
But you've been through a long labour in the sense you've been accompanying her.
Yeah, my regret is that I didn't get some sleep. I wanted to make sure that I was there for Kate, and all my instincts were telling me, when the hospital was refusing to look any further or do any tests on what was wrong with his arm, other than to tell us it was fine, I wanted to just take him and drive him to a specialist.
I just can't imagine...
But I'd been awake for 48 hours.
Yeah.
Hallucinating and all sorts.
Well, because that... I mean, when my son was born was the most kind of adrenalized and emotional I've ever been in my life. You're very fragile and you are tired.
I was crying. I was crying when he was born, yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't cried since I was about 12. By the time they transferred into Alderhay, I remember getting to the hospital and looking through a checklist, and Alderhay were just shocked. They said, "This is like third world. What? Where are all his scans? Where is the imaging? Why hasn't he got an IV line in him ready for surgery? Why has he been transmitted as a girl? It's a baby boy. We can't touch this boy because he's been transferred as a baby girl." So there were just more and more delays, and it was just like, oh my God, how bad could they get this?
They said, "We're going to do exploratory surgery."
Yep.
They explained the risks.
Yep.
And one of the risks was they might have to amputate his arm.
Yes, there and then. There was also a risk that he would die.
From having the surgery?
From either the anaesthetic or that the clotting in his arm might have backed up into his heart.
So what were you thinking at that point?
I'm going to lose my son. If they hadn't have operated when they did, 2 hours later he would have died.
Right.
They had to clean out. So they literally cut him from his lower rib all the way up under his armpit, all the way down to the elbow. So if you can imagine an incision that long in a baby that's hours old, how complicated that surgery must be. That was when they realised that the clotting was too extreme and that we were going to be talking about an amputation. But whether that would be the hand, the wrist, where the amputation was going to occur was something that Sol was going to have to decide. In other words, that they would basically wait for a line of demarcation to occur, where there's a clear line, everything south of there is necrotic or dead tissue, and then what they do is they come about an inch or so. A seasoned surgeon apparently will be a little bit aggressive in how much healthy tissue they remove, just to ensure that you have a good, clean wound at the end of it.
And what are you thinking when they say that?
When they were telling me that, initially I was very selfish, and I why me, why my baby? He's never going to be able to do the things I really love. I play guitar, I used to box, I make things with my hands, I'm a very manual person, and I got really wallowy. It was only when I realised, it was like a snapshot in my brain, when I realised some of the other children on the wards that we were on weren't going home. And that's when I just started, get a grip and stop being so wallowy and start thinking about what you can do and how you can help and how you can be a good parent watching him and helping the doctors to do their job. And I thought that was the absolute best thing that I could do. So just literally just cut off from the emotion. And I remember that actually happening, just feeling that the emotions just left me, and I just suddenly went all Spock, if that makes sense. I just went very logical and very... that's when I think I reached my phone to start Googling stuff. It's like, what can I actually do to help? It feels often that, you know, in a situation like that in hospital, there's nothing you can do, but there's always something you can do. Amputations tend to be better if you can terminate at a natural joint. Because you don't get irregular growth patterns and little spindles of bone that can grow into the soft tissue and all sorts of other horrible things. So we were told to go through the elbow, and I said no, I didn't want that. If there was a possibility of saving even an inch of bone below his elbow, then we were going to do it. They piled on the pressure, explained all the complications. I said, I'm aware of all these risks. I'm aware that he might have to have more surgery when he's 2 or 4 or 10. But if we can preserve some function, I don't want to close that door now. I don't know, you know, when I was looking at some of the things that's happening even in Cardiff, we're on the cusp of some amazing technology. I'm not going to ruin any chance that Sol has of regaining motion in that arm.
And how did the doctors take that?
They made us sign a waiver. We had to take full responsibility for that decision. Luckily, we had one of the only surgeons in the world who could walk into a theatre anywhere and be instantly recognised. Dr. Durai Nayam, that name stuck with me forever. Absolutely phenomenal guy. Did a really, really clean job of the amputation. I've got to say, the care in Alderhay was unbelievable. All the wards that we were on, we have no complaints whatsoever about the NHS in that regard. But yeah, I started thinking, how can I turn that small piece of elbow that we saved into a device? And that was really at Saul's bedside. I started thinking about engineering solutions.
Into a device?
Into a device, yeah.
I mean, that's a strange way to think. When you've basically not really left hospital,
it's actually the simplest thing that you can expect from a man, I think. Something's broken, how do I fix it? The most obvious thing that struck me was any research study that I looked at, and some really good studies, longitudinal studies that were done over 20, 30 years following amputees and the devices they've used and the rejection rates, different patterns that have been observed since the 1960s and before. And so children will reject prosthetic if there is no function introduced before the age of 2.5. Every human, every mammal, in fact, is born with 200 billion or so neurons in the brain. That's about twice the amount that you'll ever have as an adult. The first 2.5 years of life is about stripping away the noise, those nerves which don't seem to do anything. So it strengthens, the brain strengthens its own pathways that are used regularly through myelination, which is insulating the nerves so that they work more efficiently, but also creating and strengthening nerve pathways that are used on a daily basis. So by 2.5, toddler at that age has got about the same number of neurons that you or I have, 100 billion. I'm in the hospital now and I'm looking at rejection, and I'm seeing a really, really common pattern that between 40 and 70% of kids around the world will reject prosthetics very early. Once we'd had the first consultation about prosthetics in relation to Sol, we were told they wouldn't do anything until he was a year old.
Okay. And your instinct on that was, that sounds wrong.
That's just completely wrong, yeah. I read a study in Canada showing that the best age to intervene with an electric device was 12 months of age. I knew that the nerves for Sol's arm, his left hand, all the fingers and everything, were still intact at the point of amputation. It takes some time for those to disappear. And I wanted to try to promote whatever nerve pathways were there originally for the arm in any way that I could. And I was determined that I was going to do this, even in the hospital. I was watching very carefully as the nurses were applying dressings to his arm. I learnt a few techniques and strategies to get a little dressing to stay on, so... He had to have blood tests taken every 4 hours. He couldn't eat until 4 o'clock every day. No food. Try telling that to a newborn baby. You can't have food yet. It's distressing for Kate, distressing for me, distressing for everybody else on the ward as well, hearing this newborn baby screaming. And it broke me a bit, I think. Kate was very, very good at... She breastfed all the way through. And Sol had got breast milk into the wound. I remember arguing with someone on the ward saying, we need this cleaning out. So they had to call a plastic surgeon from Leeds to come all the way down to Liverpool just to look at Sol's arm. And bless him, he did. And when he got there, he concluded that it was the right thing to do, even though the ward said breast milk is sterile. Well, it's not after 4 days. And the surgeon said, right, everybody should leave now because I'm going to have to clean this wound out and it's going to be very distressing. I said, no, I'm staying here. He said, look, very brave of you to offer that, but 90% of families that want to stay eventually leave because of what they've seen and it leaves them scarred. I said, I'm not leaving his side. So I held his good hand and was feeding him little drops of sugar. He was screaming and I just kept singing to him, just singing this little song that my dad used to sing to me, and I managed to calm him down to go through this dressing change. And I stayed all the way through, but I remember thinking that, yeah, something inside me had snapped. I was no longer the same person, so I'm starting to well up a bit. I'd changed in that moment, and I just felt this bond with my son that I'd... But at the same time, I had to switch my emotions off. It was really, really weird. You feel all the love and the instinct is there, but I had to put that to one side because if I was responding to that instinct, I would have to run out of the room because I couldn't handle what I was seeing and what I was hearing. In situations like that where someone says, it's going to be bad, you don't want to stick around, and I've listened to that, then I've got a very active imagination. And what goes through my mind is usually worse than what I actually saw. Mm-hmm. So I thought, as bad as this is going to be, my son needs me to be here. He needs someone to comfort him when he's in pain. I know he's never going to remember any of this anyway, but 10-day-old baby, I wasn't going to leave him. You know, by the time we'd got home, the Moses basket we'd bought that we were hoping to put him in was already too small. Mm. It was like weird. We just kept thinking about what we'd missed, this opportunity that we'd missed, but thankful that he was alive. Sol was in his cot, and he had a jungle jam, and it was called. It's like two semicircular hoops suspended above the cot with toys dangling down. Sol still had a small dressing on his left arm, and he was banging away with the toys with his right arm. He's already at 4.5, 5 weeks of age learned not to move his left arm. It had been connected to a drip or a vacuum or something. So it's like you could see the learning taking place. He'd learned not to do anything with the left arm. So I started trying to lower the toys so that he could reach them with his stump. And if some people don't like the word stump, they prefer residual limb or paw. It's a stump. So he was reaching up with his stump, trying to bang these toys. I was trying to lower them down, and I realised I'm trying to modify the wrong thing. I've seen how dressings are done. I went into the kitchen. I had some sports bandage, some cotton wool, some micropore tape, and just the usual stuff you'd have in a first aid kit. And I got a kitchen sponge. I rolled it to approximately the same size and length as his healthy arm, from the elbow down. Fourth or fifth attempt, I'd got something that looked pretty good. It stayed on its own. It was only to be used for half an hour at a time. But within, I can't remember whether it was seconds or minutes, Sol, aged 5 weeks, just had this little blue bandage arm put on and immediately picked his hand up and started banging the toys. He's playing with both arms. That's, from my head, that's encouraging blood flow, muscle movement. I know that a big issue with upper limb amputations is the withering of the arm because it's not used, the muscles deplete, therefore the nerve signals deplete. And I'm thinking in my head, I want Sol to wear a bionic arm one day that uses nerve signals. He's not going to have that if he doesn't have any tissue development and muscle growth. So I was really, really pleased.
You'd adjusted the wrong thing, you meant...
Yeah, I was trying to lower the toys to the stump.
Rather than changing the world around him, it's about changing him.
Yeah, changing him to adapt.
And that is different to medical advice then.
Yeah, nobody's ever done this before. To my knowledge, no one's ever done this before. If it has, it's never been documented. When Sol sends a signal through his left stump, and you know, with the help of my extending foam arm, he sees an event in the world, so a toy moves. When he sends that signal out, then the brain, the visual system, is wiring to the system that controls the arms and legs, and also the feedback back from that as well, so understanding how far I can reach something. This is called proprioception, so knowing where your limb is in space as well. Mm. And I thought, this has got to be good. So I continued it, but then I continued to think, how can I? Because we'd had a consultation with the NHS, they'd said it's going to be a year before they fit a prosthetic. And when they showed us what they were going to fit, I was just creeped out by it. This
why?
Because, are you familiar with the uncanny valley principle?
No.
All right, the uncanny valley says that robots or anything that was just trying to imitate a human can be liked by humans till the appearance is too similar, when it's not quite right but still looks very human. So the silicon hand that they provide has fake fingernails and fake wrinkles in the skin, and it's just... it's trying to look, it looks like it's trying to replace something, like it's trying to hide the fact that he's missing a limb. And we were very conscious to just think practically, I don't care what it looks like so long as it increases his function and he uses it. So the most successful device that's been made for children like Sol is called the split hook. So there's a cable that runs from a hook on the hand, and the hook is naturally shut by a very strong elastic band. But when you extend the arm, the cable that tensions over the shoulder will run tight and it'll open the hook. And the main reason people don't wear them is because their appearance. So I thought, well, you know, 80% of kids that wear them go on to use them their whole life, and they won't even look at bionics because they get this reliable function. They got this, they can do stuff with it.
So by the time you had this consultation after a few months, you're sitting there thinking, I've been building things at home that might be more effective than what he's doing.
Yes, because it was introduced at the right time. The actual thought sequence I was having, lying in bed, 2 a.m, staring at the ceiling, just thinking how I could make this, who I could approach to develop something very, very simple. And I thought, well, instead of using EMG signals, which are complicated and can be obscured by puppy fat, what if I had like a small rubber gland inside the socket of a rigid prosthetic that had a little micro switch inside it? So Sol, just by moving that small piece of bone that we'd managed to save, if you could just activate this little sensor inside the prosthetic, then in theory we could start introducing bionics from a year old when the NHS would help. And I looked at the ceiling and there was a spider on the ceiling, and then I remembered again, just came back to me, something I'd seen on a nature program, that spiders use fluid pressure to actuate their legs. So when they want to put weight through or put strain through the leg, they actually use a muscle, and then it flicks back to its original position by blood pressure. And I thought, bingo, fluid. 2 small bags of fluid inside the socket, just before and after the hinge of his small elbow. And as he squishes one bag of fluid, it'll put fluid pressure through a system and open a thumb, fixed fingers but a movable thumb. And then he could push on the other bag to close it again, so he'd have two-way control. I think a lot of the designers that I'd seen working on open source projects, such as the wonderful work that Enable and Team Unlimited do, so they make open source 3D printable arms, there's too much focus on the complexity of the hand. So if you have a 3-year-old running around with a 3D printed hand with little fingers on it and they fall over, that finger becomes a choking hazard when it breaks off. Mm-hmm. It's also very complicated and it takes a lot of time to build. Whereas the NHS version had rigid but squishy rubber fingers, so if Sol fell over it would act like a shock absorber. I'd gone back to B&Q, where I'd been working, and I'd got bits and bobs I'd borrowed from my parents, and I'd managed to make a hydraulic cylinder. So that's a tube with a piston inside it and 2 ports. You push fluid in, the piston goes back or forth depending on which actuator you push. So I made one of those. Sol's first appointment with the prosthetist. He'd been a prosthetist for 40 years. He'd seen many, many children come through the Wrexham Limb Centre. He told me to prepare that Sol was a very well-behaved little boy, but when he comes to put this wet plaster cast on Sol's arm, Sol's going to wriggle and kick and scream and do all sorts. They all do. Because Sol had had this sponge arm put on every day, all the way through his first year, I just said, no, Sol will be fine. Sol, stump up. Sol lifted his arm up like I was going to put his arm on for him, and he held his arm perfectly still, so this really nice cast was taken. Didn't wriggle. I mean, as you can imagine, if a kid moves while the cast is still moist and soggy, that's going to create, you know, it's going to deform it and it won't fit. And in my experience, most NHS arms just fall off when they get home. They don't stay on. So we're really lucky that we had a prosthetist with such experience, and that I'd done this earlier groundwork that meant that a perfect cast was taken, and that it fit really well. So I remember going to get that fitted. It was 11 weeks after the cast. Went there, Sol put it on, he wore it home and never took it off. So that was partly because of the work that I'd done, but partly because Sol was so lucky to have such an experienced prosthetist who's sadly retired now. I went to Bangor University. They just opened an innovation centre called Pontio. Pontio means bridges in Welsh. And they hadn't even opened the doors to the public, but I knew that they'd bought a £300,000 printer. Most people think of 3D printing, you think of desktop trinkets, little rigid pieces of plastic. The Stratasys machine that we were working on in Bangor University was, I think it was £300,000, and it can produce plastics as hard as ABS plastic, like Lego brick, fused into something as supple as patent leather, and all these different materials in between. So it was an absolutely phenomenal machine. I thought that would be brilliant. I could make a rigid socket with the supple actuators all built in one go. So I was back and forth with Bangor University for about 6 months.
And did you have a relationship with the university already?
No. My sister works in the university. She made that initial connection for us. But it's open to the public. This innovation centre is open to businesses and the public. I decided that things were going too slow. I wasn't paying the university anything for this, and therefore I couldn't hold them accountable for any delays in getting stuff done. They were just opening up. I didn't have the money or the skills to do it myself, so I thought I'll have a go at trying to see if I can do CAD design. You know, I've done kitchen design. Can I do CAD design? So I contacted SolidWorks.
CAD just means computer-aided.
Computer-aided design, sorry, yeah. Right.
So that's just sitting at a computer,
yeah,
rather than what you'd been doing before was botching stuff together from me.
Putting it, yeah, manually. Yeah, yeah, gluing stuff. And yeah. So okay. I wanted to see if I could create a file that could be printed,
yeah,
that my son could wear. One of the things the university did have, not on the 3D printing side, but on still in 3D, but scanning, they had a £14,000 scanner, which would pick up the individual hairs on your head. We just received Sol's first prosthetic, so the first thing we did was scan that prosthetic arm. So we had a virtual file for computer-aided design of the entire prosthetic.
That would you knew would fit him?
Oh, yeah, it was perfect, exactly the same size. And that meant that once I had that CAD file, I could then print it off and make new ones. So if Sol lost the arm or the dog chewed it, at least I had a replica. That was great. I was doing gardening jobs and all sorts at that stage. And between March and July 2016, I was just doing anything I could to get money to pay the mortgage. And I decided, you know, if I'm going to... I can either try and do this and put everything I've got into it and set it up as a business and push it, or I can just accept that my house is in negative equity. I can't get a job in Wales teaching because my Welsh language isn't good enough. Take the loss, sell the house, move over the border, back up to Burnley where Kate's family live, and just that's if I couldn't get this going here, that's what I was going to try and do. But I thought since it was going to clearly help my son and me, This is what I put everything into Ambionics.
And the business, that's the first time you've used the word business.
Yeah.
What I mean, in a sentence, what was your vision for a business?
The business at that point was to try and develop this hydraulic idea I'd had, but which was nothing more than a sketch and a few laughable prototypes, but they did work. They were functional prototypes. They didn't leak and they transmitted pressure in the way that they were supposed to, but they looked, you know, like something out of Frankenstein's nightmare. But the business was to really try and push this early intervention, this idea of fitting... wouldn't be kitchen sponge, it'd be hypoallergenic proper medical sponge, but doing that from a very, very early age, getting the parents to commit to rehabilitation rather than just saying scrap it, we'll come back in a year and see what the NHS can do. I just thought that was the way to go. So I wanted to develop the hydraulics. I needed to get funding to do that, and you can't get funding as an individual, so I set up Ambionics. Ambionics, take the name, is additive manufacturing. It's 3D printing, so additive manufactured bionics became Ambionics. We didn't get any funding. I tried to do a crowd fund, raise £200 from my closest friends. Then a contact of mine, Jamie Hutchinson, is an old school friend, said he wanted to introduce a policeman, a very, very high-ranking policeman from North Wales Police. He introduced me. And the first thing this guy did, I can't mention his name, he said, right, you're looking to do CAD design. You're going to need a computer to do that on. What specs does this computer need to be? And he went out and bought me one, just gave it to me. Just, here's a laptop, you're doing amazing work, you need help, I'm in a position to help. I would not be here today without this laptop.
Wow.
What a guy. Within 3 months' time, I had a fully working prototype. By the time I came to put it on Sol, it was too small. I was trying to chase a moving target. Mm. So I had this prototype with actuators inside and the hydraulics inside, and I could not get it on my son's arm by the time I printed it off. I was just beside myself. I thought, right, I can't scan an NHS socket. There has to be a better way of doing this, scanning the arm and creating a socket. I thought, well. So I decided to do a crowdfund to see it, because I hadn't been successful getting any grants or early crowdfunding attempts had failed. So I thought, I'll do a big press release. Times New York covered it all the way through to the Times in South Korea. It was absolutely, you know, every single channel, every single newspaper we were in, some of them had got the story right, some of them had got it wrong. But we were in the public eye. Over the full 2 months of the crowdfund, only 600 people backed us, and we got 9% of what we were looking for at the time. So
which was how much?
I'd been told that I needed 50,000 to do prototyping. Just put that in context, I've done most of it myself for 12 grand. I needed 20,000 to patent. I've done most of that myself for just under 10. That we need 80,000 to certificate it as safe use for a medical device. Prosthetics are class 2 medical devices, and it's illegal to sell them if they're not regulated.
And so this is to crowdfund a company that could make molds for children all over the world.
Could make, yeah.
And so with that money, theoretically,
yeah.
Someone could say, I live in Kansas, my son's had the same injury when he was born,
yeah.
Here's a scan of his arm, and you could make a limb for them.
Yes, yeah. So we managed to get 20,000 of the 150 that we asked for. I was really scared about spending a penny of it because I thought there's not enough here to last. But the least I can do is work on this full time now and pay the mortgage. So I was taking like £800, £1,000 a month out just to meet the minimum commitments and living on nothing still. It was just mortgage was about £800 a month.
What does Kate make of all this?
You'd have to ask her. She's very proud, but I... she wants it to be a success, but I think she's seen what I've seen as well. And I do feel guilty that this started off about my son, and the business has been a major distraction. I'd be a lot further along now if I just didn't have any bother with any of the media, but if I'd had 2 3D printers and CAD design, I'd be a lot further ahead than I am. But what I decided to do after the crowdfund, it didn't fail, I got some money, but I decided to do a beta trial. People, I was asking the world, with no qualifications in medicine, no qualifications in engineering, no nothing other than being a loving dad, a bit ballsy perhaps. I didn't even have a prototype that worked well enough to say this can be certificated. So here I was with no credentials, asking for $150,000. No investor wanted to touch that. Did get some kind of what I would call pity money, people who felt sorry for us and wanted to try and make it happen. So I had to become credible. So I used the last 12 months, so from March last year to March this year, you know, I taught myself 3D printing, bought two printers, the printers that have the same functionality as a £3,000 printer. They were £700 each, but you've got to build them yourself.
So where are you up to with the business now?
We've got a working mechanism, and my son has been wearing one of my prosthetics since June last year, so I've made four for him now. I set up to do an international trial. I got lots and lots of interest. So I'm working with families in Ecuador, Australia, Albania, the UK, India, all around the world.
They're also working with families. There's a child in India wearing one of your prostheses.
There's a child in India waiting to receive one of my arms, yes. There's a little girl in Albania who's already received one. There's a lad down the coast. It made sense to work with the kid who's 20 miles away. He's been wearing one. The NHS have been trying to make him an arm since October. They've tried four times and they can't get it right. I did it in 5 days. The NHS have now changed his intervention from looking at purely cosmetic options to looking at functional options because he's done so well with... And because it doesn't look creepy, it's not like this creepy doll's hand. It's... If you have a look at my hands, they look semi-robotic. They're very identifiable as human, but the hand is blue, the fingers are bright white so that you can see when they're dirty. It's just got this movable thumb. It looks cool. Yeah, that's what the first thing kids look at, and it looks cool. They fit perfectly, and... That makes kids want to wear them.
And presumably it makes the parents want to deal with you as well, knowing that you've been through the same thing they have.
Yeah, but I have to tell them again, you know, they've all signed to say that they know I'm not a medical practitioner. I have no qualifications in prosthetics. We've been peer-reviewed, so all of the applicants had to be peer-reviewed by medical experts. So that's nice now that we've not just got a pat on the back for being a good dad, but medically what we're talking about makes perfect sense. Nobody's challenged any of my ideas on the neurology of what's happening in the developing infant brain and how that relates to prosthetics. That's all now taken as read. I've submitted the patent application myself, so I've got a UK patent pending, and I've just requested an international patent, which I'm negotiating now with the offices in Switzerland. So, you know, we've got everything that we just add funding.
Well, on that, how much does it cost? So if I'm in Germany and my son's born with a similar situation to Sol and I get in touch with you, how much does it cost me to do an arm?
At the minute, I wouldn't be able to sell them because they're not certified. But I know families who've tried to get onto our beta trial. I originally set it open for 10 families. My heart's bigger than my brain's. I opened that up to 20 families. So everybody else after that I had to reject. And one of those families went off and bought a private arm from a company called TVRS. And they paid €4,000 for that, literally... plastic cast device with a silicon hand stuffed on the end of it. That's €4,000. For each arm in the NHS, it's about £1,000 of clinical costs per arm, and they give two arms per year. So that's £2,000 clinical costs. The arms themselves, if it's just a passive, are anything between £350 and £550. Most of those get wasted because they don't fit. So we're looking to lower the clinical cost from £1,000 per arm to £300 an arm by using families to actually do the scanning. Now, kids kick and scream inside a limb centre, but when they're asleep, again, drawing on my psychology, when a kid's in REM sleep, so about 90 minutes after they go to sleep and their eyes are moving, they're paralysed. It's beautiful. They can't move, they can't fidget. So mum and dad can go in, or two people can go in. It takes one to hold the arm steady and the other one to take a... I can do the scan in about 60 seconds now, just using an Xbox Kinect for £20. Yeah, so this isn't... You're not talking really expensive technology. And I've proved in principle that works. I've now made seven arms using that process. I've now got hundreds of families that want to do trials for nothing, and yeah, a lot of goodwill as well.
But what would it cost them if this
is up? So yeah, we're looking at our business plan at the moment, 5 years time, is to reduce that clinical cost from 1,000 to 300 per arm, and I think really the entire intervention for a child is about £2,500, and that's profitable for us.
Wow.
So that's, and that's as many arms as they need. We can also, with a digital file as well, if a kid gets the measles or chickenpox, the weight can go up and down and the arms can fall off and cause friction burns. So my son has a slightly larger and a slightly smaller socket. I can just if one day it looks like he's eating too much at Christmas, just put a slightly bigger socket on. That's something you can't do when you're physically making plaster cast.
And when you now go for an appointment with Sol to a physiotherapist or to a plastic surgeon or a prosthetist within the NHS, are they a bit scared of you?
No, I hope not. The new prosthetist I've only met twice in Wrexham. I know she's struggling to get devices to fit properly. What I'd really love to
do is... They're daunted, though, when they meet you. You spend your whole life immersed in the thing that they're doing, but coming at it from a completely different point of view.
I think this is the future. Yeah, I don't think... The resistance I've met in discussions, I either find prosthetists that are 100% behind what I'm doing and are already doing it. In America, this isn't a big thing. They're like, I know loads of Canadians and Americans that are 3D printing prosthetic. One really cool guy who actually goes in a van with a hammock in the back of it and a 3D printer. He just drives through poor countries making prosthetics for people, and that's his holiday. What a dude. I think I'm just advancing what was already coming. But the saddest thing that recently happened is I just realised the first father to come and try and get help from me for his own daughter had another agenda. So over the last year, he's been trying to get close, finding out how I do what I do and where I'm going with the business. And actually, he's been setting up his own company, which has been funded. And his idea is slightly more palatable to prosthetists because it still involves them in the process. So taking a cast, filling that full of plaster Paris to create a positive impression, and then scanning that. So it's a lot more involved, but it still keeps prosthetists in the loop, whereas what I'm doing is a bit more disruptive. So the way I see myself is more like Invisalign. So it used to cost £6,000 for orthodontic braces, and the orthodontist had to be there every step of the way, which is why it was so expensive. Invisalign came along, have lower level technicians dealing with you for most of your journey, and then the orthodontist just signs off at the end. So we're trying to look at that model where parents do a lot of the work, the prosthetist just signs off the device to see if whether it's safe for use at the end, and that's how we can reduce the clinical cost. So that's quite disruptive. I think prosthetists either have to get on board with the new technology or resist it, and I am seeing that resistance. Also from the open source brigade as well. There's a lot of people who say that I should have open sourced what I'm doing. I agree, that was the original intention. I set up to create a not-for-profit, and we had to close that business because we got no support whatsoever. Set up a private equity company with the possibility of investing, set the patent, and we got a lot of interest now from an investor. We've raised 43,000 over the last 12 months. I need 7,000 more to get matched funded investment from the Development Bank of Wales, which is why I'm doing this next crowdfund. And hopefully I'm going to smash it out of the park, and we'll be having to ask for money again.
Ben Ryan. And you can find out more about him, Sol, and Ambionics at ambionics.co.uk. Still to come, our record of the week and Alex Fox's erotic review is up next after this. Time to get our pulses racing. It's the Foxhole with a lady whose pulse is racing not because of the usual reasons, but because she just had a swig of cold brew coffee. It's Alex Fox.
Hello, Ollie. I hope you're feeling tip-top from your top to your tips.
What have you been up to this week?
Well, I've just come back from Belgium, which henceforth I'm going to be calling Belgium, because I was there for the annual Chasse aux Sex Toys, which is a literal hunt for buried treasure, or indeed buried pleasure. They bury 800 sex toys in a field, and then you have to go and dig for them.
Why?
Well, it was originally organised by a sex toy company called Soft Love. The word soft in Belgium and France seems to have more connotations of being sensual and sensitive rather than flaccid. Yeah. There were 9,800 people there this year.
And is there a special thrill to uncovering a dong in the dung?
I can't tell you, Ollie, because I dug until I had blisters on my palms.
You didn't find anything?
And I found nothing.
Oh no, is it going to be left for landfill?
No, they all just got found.
Oh, they did
and
get
I
found.
Yeah, okay. I didn't
Otherwise,
find a
Otherwise, what
dick.
Would future generations make of that?
It was the best sexual workout I've ever had.
It's time for our listener question, sponsored by our friends at mycondom.com.
Who sell condoms, lubes and toys, all sent to you in discreet wrapping. Mm. So you won't get a package that's actually shaped like a package, and it won't be emblazoned with a label saying, this is first class bungs for your ass, or special delivery to make your wife's boink flume slippery.
And our question is from Jen, who says, Alex, several episodes back you mentioned there were podcasts out there for a listener to listen to on their way home so that they could jumpstart getting into the mood. Can you share them, please? And I'm pleased to say that in answering this question today, we have been joined by the god of erotica. It's Ollie Peart.
It's nice in this bit of the podcast, isn't it?
Alex, you're going to play us some clips, I understand, and then Ollie and I are going to review them.
And that is the case, yes.
Season finale, ladies and gentlemen.
I've tried to get a real range of different types of erotica because, as we often say on The Foxhole, different people like different things.
Punishment, you said it was.
Well, I just think this might make you uncomfortable. I could be wrong. Let's find out.
Well, our first clip comes from the spicily, fragrantly named Rose Caraway, who hosts the Kiss Me Quick erotica podcast. Now, this one is in and out of the number one slot, so to speak, in the erotica category on iTunes all the time. So it's popular with a lot of people.
I didn't actually know there was an erotica category in Apple Podcasts.
There
that's
is indeed, yeah.
Okay, and so that's your first port of call then, isn't it?
Well, Rose is also known as the Sexy Librarian, and I did browse through her library of audiobooks that she reads out. I'm not sure about some of them. They tend to have characters in them with names like Hampton and Rusty, which I think sound like a posh person's dogs. But these are probably the most traditionally formatted of all the stories that I've chosen. If you like a kind of little piece of saucy fiction with a clear beginning, middle and an end, then this may well tickle your pickle.
Okay, let's have a listen.
They went on like this for a bit, and when Rusty's hand slipped out of mine and onto my leg, I tore my eyes from the scene to meet his. My heart still throttled from the terror of the last few acts, but this one, sexy and blatant as it was, had twisted the anxiety into something far more pleasant. The woman let out an extremely satisfied cry, and both of us turned back. The man groaned and grabbed onto her sides, but she crawled away, leaving his cock hard and glistening under the stage lights as she dipped down out of sight behind the bed.
What if people are on a bus listening, getting a boner?
She sounds a bit like she's selling jewellery on QVC. That's what it sounded like to me.
It is a bit cubic zirconia,
yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly.
The glistening cock was just hilarious.
Now,
more
I know what
sexy.
She means. She means like the kind of, you know, it's lubed up and slick and it's maybe got that dewdrop of pre-cum on the end of it.
But what's it doing with a load of stage lights around it? Is it an old dressing room mirror? That's the bit I didn't understand.
It's a glistening glitter cock. It's a disco dick. Can we also talk about satin sheets? This couple are apparently writhing on red satin sheets. Mm. In my younger days, I thought that satin and silk sheets were incredibly sensual and that, you know, anyone who walked into my bedroom would immediately want to hump the life out of me because they'd be so seduced by my boudoir. In reality, they were just so slippery that I actually once slipped and knocked myself out on my board. So yeah, I think they're a bit of a red herring.
Fine,
when
but
it
people
comes
don't
to the
come
boning.
To erotica, do they, for reality? I mean, it's supposed to be escapism, isn't it? The idea of satin is soft and sensual, right? You see what she's going for?
I do, but actually some people do come to erotica for more of a dose of the real thing, something believable and tangible that they can really buy into, which segues neatly onto clip number two. Okay. Now, this one comes from a girl who's usually a blogger, and this woman kicks ass harder than someone roundhousing a donkey whilst wearing hobnail boots. Her name is Girl on the Net, or her anonymous name is Girl
oh,
on the
I've
Net.
Heard, I've heard of her.
Yeah, we've referenced her before. She's an excellent, excellent woman.
She's all over Twitter as well, isn't she?
She is all over Twitter, slapped all over Twitter.
Does she write erotica?
She does write some erotic blog posts, mm-hmm. and she's recently started recording them. And this is her voice that you're going to hear. Now, I know Girl on the Net personally, so I wondered whether this might be a bit weird for me. But there is something about how believable and real she is that, for me, gave it an extra frisson. It feels like you're not just listening to somebody reading out a story in order to turn you on. You're eavesdropping on somebody giving a really vivid account of something that's genuine to them. But let's see what you make of it.
I mean, Ollie's body language is already receptive, I would say. Crossed arms.
Yeah, I'm kind of dreading it.
He's casually gripping his cock while we sit at opposite ends of the sofa. It's hard for me to keep my eyes off his hands when he won't keep his hands off his dick. So I stare. And I stare. And I stare, and eventually I say, "Are you having a shower before we go out?" "Yeah," he says. "Can I watch?" "You want to watch me shower?" "Yeah," I tell him, "and maybe I just kind of want to stare a little bit more while you soap up your dick and, what, vigorously beat one out for your entertainment?" "Yeah, exactly that," Exactly that, I tell him. And he says, okay.
Well, now she sounds filthy.
Do you see what I mean about it being more real? It doesn't sound performative. It sounds like you're really listening to something that someone has absolutely gotten off on.
Is this one, do you think, more for men than women? Because I did find the emphasis on dick so much. I mean, that's just a tiny little clip, but that seemed to me like more of a male fantasy that a woman would be saying, oh, your dick, whereas probably erotica aimed at women wouldn't be so focused on men's genitals.
Girl on the Net is just legitimately dick hungry. A lot. A lot of the erotica that she writes is based on real life situations as well. This isn't a fantasy that she's invented in her head. It's something she's really done with a partner she really loves and really fancies. And I think that shows in the writing. It's utterly believable to me, and I find it a lot sexier as a result. What did you think about the bit where she stared and stared and stared at his cock?
Bit rude.
It did make me laugh a little bit that she stared at it so long and then asked him if he was going to wash it, because that sounded like it might be a bit crusty.
Okay, so I'm liking that. Have we got any other British suggestions, by the way, on your list?
Well, the next one is an American voice, I think, and it is a slightly different format. In the past, Ollie, you and I have spoken about sex chat lines. Peach Booth is a kind of simulated version of that. It's a series of podcasts, and I think there's some YouTube videos as well, all sorts of different types of audio that are designed to make it sound as though you are listening in on a real-life conversation that's going on one of those sex chat lines. Mm-hmm. So let's drop in.
Unfortunately, it's not totally unfortunately. I have really good orgasms, but I only come clitorally.
Yeah, that seems to be the dividing line I've noticed. Like, the girls who actually do orgasm from being penetrated, they tend to be just getting really fucking wet. They're the ones that are more than likely going to be squirters. I mean, I've only been with two or three actually squirt.
I like to be like that. I'm very sexual, but that has nothing to do with it. It's just different how sexual you are, like how you come. Doesn't have anything to do with how sexual you are. But just saying I'm very sexual, but I just come clitorally, but maybe one day that'll change. I hope so. I watch these women in porn squirting, and I wish that I could do it. It's really fucking hot.
Yeah, it is.
I've never listened to a podcast, you know, whilst in the background you can hear the sound of someone masturbating furiously before, and I'm not sure I like it.
Bad line as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
There was one call I listened into where, though, I don't know what the dude was touching himself with, but you could hear him furiously going at it with his pole, and it was doing a kind of strange sort of Monty Python clip-clop coconut sound. It sounded like there was a little tiny horse involved in the scenario.
What I find quite interesting about all three clips you played so far is that they tap into an element of voyeurism, don't they? None of them actually are someone sexy talking to you and involving you in a sexual situation as a listener. They're all you eavesdropping on something sexual going on.
Well, let's try something totally different then. Brace yourselves, boys.
Jesus
Hard to tell nationality from that one, isn't it?
Good, the number of people listening on public transport. This is amazing. Oh, you poor bastards.
Well, that is the real life sound of a woman orgasming, and it comes from a collection of over 750 different female orgasms that have been put together on the orgasmsoundlibrary.com.
Now, why was that not part of my Encarta CD-ROM?
You asked about nationality. Well, these recordings come from 51 different countries, and I've actually got some stats about the situations under which they were recorded. Apparently, 13% of the tapes happened in bed. Just under 4.5% of them were people wanking on the sofa. And then we had 1.2% in cars.
I hope they weren't driving at the same time, because if you're masturbating and recording yourself in high quality whilst driving a car, I'm pretty sure that must be illegal.
Quite a skill, though.
Well, if you feel like getting X-rated in a BMW, then you can actually contribute your own orgasm sound to the
library. Oh, I know what I'm doing tonight. Yep.
I'm pretty sure that this is restricted only to lady gasms.
Oh, that's a shame.
I think it's just one for the girls.
What's it called?
It's called orgasmsoundlibrary.com, and it was put together, the project was put together by a sex toy company called Bijou Indiscret.
And finally.
Well, this one's my favourite one. I got lost down this rabbit hole whilst inserting things into my own rabbit hole. I cannot recommend hard enough the Reddit Gone Wild audio section. It's full of submissions of naughty recordings of people either alone or with a consenting partner. Some of them are just going at it naturally and the recording is of their spontaneous sounds and conversations. Others of them are performances of scripts, and sometimes people who are on the Reddit notice boards contribute their own scripts, and then someone else in another part of the world will perform them for them. There's all sorts there. You can search according to loads of hashtags, like if you're after a particular kind of accent or specific type of content. There's loads and loads to choose from.
Okay, and we're going to hear one of those.
I didn't choose the one that got me all excited because, quite frankly, I was worried about getting sued for damaging the soft furnishings in the studio where we are in currently. So this is something slightly different. This is someone with a very British accent talking about rather different usage of farming equipment.
Good morning, ladies. Today we will be demonstrating the proper method for draining a boy. As you know, milking boys is necessary to keep them submissive. A boy that isn't thoroughly drained on a daily schedule can become unruly and undisciplined, which is unacceptable. When all of you ladies leave this class, you'll be able to purchase your own male and will need to be well practiced in the fine arts of ball draining to keep your property obedient. Now, let's bring out the test subject. This one was purchased for my home use, but I felt he would be fitting for the class demonstration. Notice he has a leash on him. Males who haven't been milked recently often require a leash in case they get unruly. Let's bring him to the milking block. Come here, boy. Come here. Don't be frightened. Good boy. Now, I will remove his Velcro pouch and expose his genitals. There. Bring your boy up to the milking block so his genitals are coming out of the hole on the other side of the milking block. Now securely fasten his wrists and ankles to the milking block with the attached leather straps. There. All ready.
Was he wearing a bum bag? His Velcro pouch?
I mean, I'll never listen to the Archer's Omnibus in the same way.
Some people like that kind of educational schoolmarm vibe.
Yeah.
So it's all very prim and proper. Because if you're somebody who is into being told that you're not allowed to get excited, then that kind of strict language can enhance that role play for you.
I liked the sense of it being a prolonged foreplay process. That was quite nice. That works well in audio, doesn't it? But I still couldn't quite tell whether I, as the listener, was supposed to be the milker or the milky.
It was a bit like ASMR as well, and also more like comedy than erotica.
Okay, Jen, so there you go. Hopefully you've had some enjoyable suggestions there. If people want to check out these links, Alex, will you send them to me? I'll put them on the website.
Yeah, we'll pop them on modernman.co.uk.
Yes.
I know we've been having a giggle, but there were many recordings that made me pleasurably wriggle, so yeah, it's definitely worth checking these out.
Well, generally speaking, one tends not to listen to erotica in company.
It might be worth listening to it together with your partner, though.
You looked at Ollie when you said that. I thought you were suggesting just me and him go off to the corner.
There are people in this world as well for whom the idea of the two Ollies listening to audio
No, don't finish
together.
That sentence. Can't bear
it. Stop it.
Okay, if you have a question of sex for Alex Fox for the next season of The Modern Man, what do you need to do?
You need to just hop on over to our website, which is modernmanwith2ns.co.uk, and hit feedback.
And if you want to actually have some real sex, not simulated sex in your ears at some point over the next few days,
go to mycondom.com and use the code FOXHOLE, that's FOXHOLE, for 15% off everything.
Excellent. Thank you, Alex. Thank you for all your hard work this season. And Ollie, you're going to try harder on your next challenge, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, that is nearly it for this season of The Modern Man, but we do just have time to appoint a new ambassador. It is Samuel who says, Ollie, last year my girlfriend Cassinia and I moved around the world from Russia to Uruguay via London. Our one constant was your podcast, which we listen to in the car each week. We're now headed towards Southern Hemisphere winter, so would you consider warming our commute by making us ambassadors for Uruguay? Sam, it is done. And if you require some Ollie Man in your car for the next few weeks, may I recommend my other podcasts, The Week Unwrapped and Answer Me This. Music now, and our theme is by Django Django from their self-titled debut album. And here is our record of the week. It's from solo artist Inner Tongue. It's called Next Day, and it'll be out soon.
on Mount Silver Records. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and we'll see you next month.
The market is crashing 2 times a day. Nowadays that's okay. It's just like you say. Think about it next life. The